again. Thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, in studio, won't let me down, sitting across the table from me, it's the big fizzy, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm here, yes, in studio. It's a little chilly out today. But yeah, I'm here, man. I'm feeling good.
I see you've got your Cowboys jersey on. You got a big grin on your face. Get your Alabama cap on.
Yeah, there's been a lot of crying going on around here. And
I can still hear it from over there in the east of where we're at. I can still hear the wailing of the lost Cowboy souls that they've got over there.
I can't believe they thought they were going to beat LA. I mean, how delusional they are. I'm not a big NFL guy, so like I really don't follow the Cowboys and other teams. I know people are shocked by that.
They're not even my team. I don't even watch NFL football.
But college football, now that is something I do enjoy. Because
you're a Bama fan to the core, right?
Yeah.
Roll Tide?
Yeah. I am so glad that Alabama lost. I know there's a lot of people listening right now. That's it. They're going to unsubscribe. I'm sorry. If you're a true Alabama fan, that's cool. If you went to that school, that's cool. That's your home state. Absolutely understand.
Yeah.
But you would not believe the amount of bandwagon jumpers that live in and around the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex that all have Alabama stickers on. And I'm like, these are all Johnny-come-latelys. They're a fan of Alabama because Alabama's been good the last 10 years. Before that, the same clowns had USC.
Yep.
Before that, you know, who knows what it is. Look, I'm from Texas. I'm a Texas Longhorns fan. I don't care if they stink. Yeah, they're terrible.
They're awful.
I'm still a fan.
Still a fan.
I'm not going to put an Alabama jersey on. I don't care.
No.
And they didn't just get beat. They got destroyed.
I like all the Texas
national championship.
Oh, dude. 44-16.
I mean, that's a whipping. You could see the look on the people's face in the game. Like, Alabama's so used to destroying everybody that they didn't know what to do.
Well, in the first quarter, they put up 13.
Yeah.
In the first quarter.
So you're like, oh, it's going to be a back-to-back
close game. Tigers had 14. And so you could tell, like, ooh, Alabama's like, you know, they're used to coming out guns blazing and putting them down. And then the second quarter, 17 points scored by Clemson, 3 by Bama. And that was it. That was it. Now, it was scoreless in the fourth.
It was a lot like, you ever seen the movie Miracle about the 1980 men's Olympic hockey team?
I love that movie.
Do you remember when that movie's, when the game is dwindling down at the end of the third period, how the Soviet coach and Kurt Russell's character, like, look at him. He doesn't know what to do. Because the Russians have been dominating everyone.
Yep.
That was what Alabama looked like. It, like, literally the players and the fans were shocked. Like, we've never been, no one's ever beating us. Not by this much.
You remember, you and I have had this discussion, too, about this, is when Teddy Atlas was on Joe Rogan's podcast. And he was talking about Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
And he said that Mike Tyson had only had 8 real fights in his whole career.
He wasn't a boxer. He was a bully. He labeled him.
Yeah. And as we said, he's only had 8 real fights in his whole career, and he lost all of them.
And
it makes sense. He's like, he beat you before you ever got in there, and then he just punished you when you got in there.
Anytime somebody put him to a test, he pretty much failed,
That's what Teddy said. Yeah, he said anytime he was tested, he failed.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, that's some big words to be talking
about.
I
never thought about it like that, though. I was like, what is he talking about? The guy was a dominator. He was. But anytime anybody gave him any trouble.
And this is coming from, you know, I'm not judging him either way, but this is coming from Teddy Atlas, one of his coaches, whom, you know, him and Mike had a little problem. And, you know, everybody knows the story behind that. If you don't, you can look it up yourself of the trouble that they had. But, yeah, it's the same thing is like you said, Alabama had that same look. Like, they weren't ready for somebody that wouldn't go away.
Yeah. They didn't know what to do.
What was it? A few years ago, A&M beat them.
Yeah.
Same thing at home. Yeah. A&M went to Alabama and beat them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, I don't know. But, yeah, so.
Hats off to Clemson. Great game. Congratulations to the Tigers. But this is not a sports show, so I know people.
It's an off-the-cuff show.
No, it's not. But that was an interesting experiment. We released an off-the-cuff episode where we just kind of talked everything non-paranormal. And it went well. We got a lot of feedback. We got a lot of emails.
Y'all got some great names coming out, too.
A lot of good names. And for the most part, it seemed like people enjoyed it. So I think we're going to do another one, possibly this week.
Yeah, might as well. It's fun. We get in here. We have a little fun. We have to have some mixed drinks or something and then get rolling, see what happens.
It was fun. Well, let's get into the news. Check this out. This comes from a listener named Justin. He says, hey, guys, love the show and look forward to every episode. I have 2 stories to share, and I will start with the possible Bigfoot activity. Both of these are very true experiences. Now, my father is really into hunting and would take us, me and my siblings, as kids. I grew up in the woods and never really had any fears of the woods. We had some property that sat next to a large wooded area. Now, as a kid, I would go out and would go on adventures in these woods. I must have been around 11 or 12 when this happened, but one time, while I was out exploring, I found a giant pile of trees and sticks deep in the woods. It looked as if someone had pushed them together with a bulldozer or something like that, but it was in the middle of the woods. I wasn't frightened by it, nor did I think Bigfoot back then. It was about 15 feet wide and big enough for me to not see in the middle. I decided to climb the pile to get to the top. When I got to the top, the center of it was concave inward. I was a little freaked out when I looked in the middle and I found three white-tailed deer bodies ripped into shreds.
Yikes.
They appeared to be fresh kills, and back then I thought either a hunter, a bear, or a coyote probably put them there. I quickly got down and backed away from it in fear of the fresh kill attracting other predators. I noticed a weird mound of dirt and earth that was about 30 feet away from this tree pile. I went over to the pile to check it out. Now, the pile was about 4 feet high, and I would say about 8 feet in diameter. As I got close enough, I could see a huge hole that led inside the dirt pile and into the earth. It was dark, and I got scared right away. I figured this was some kind of predator den. I ran out of the woods and stayed away from that spot for a very long time. Now, about 5 years later, I decided to return to that location and check it out again. The pile of trees were completely gone. The dirt mound was still there, but the hole was now filled in. It was very odd in general. The deer carcasses is what freaked me out the most, and how close the mound was to that tree pile. This occurred in Virginia. Man, what do you think of that story?
Not the predator like we like to talk about, but a predator like a coyote or a bobcat or mountain lion.
possible Bigfoot. I mean,
or a Sasquatch.
Well, you hear those stories of the makeshift lean-tos that the Sasquatch are known to make, the breaking over of trees,
yep, yeah,
and something had stashed
these critters in there.
But I will say this, and even if it has nothing to do with Sasquatch, if they're just, for whatever reason, a bunch of trees, a tornado, something caused them to fall, it's not uncommon for like a mountain lion or a cat, large cat like that, to stash its kill.
Yeah.
Either sometimes up in a tree, sometimes under some rocks, definitely inside a pile of logs. Something, because
no cats in North America stash them in trees.
But you've seen leopards and stuff do that,
yeah,
right?
The African cats will do it. A lot of them will cover them like a bear. A bear will cover up the dead whenever they clean a carcass.
Like moose carcasses.
Yeah, and then
they
urinate all over it and cover it all up. Yeah, and the whole thing.
So, I mean, it could be that.
Maybe that's the way Bigfoot gets down.
Could be Sasquatch. Who knows?
I don't know of anything, though, that would, look, if it's the way it is, unless it was done by a poacher and they piled the brush up and threw what was left of the deer after they had, you know,
right,
killed them and done all that stuff and threw it in there, I could understand that. But outside of that, I don't know of anything in North America that not only just kills and then piles them up. Usually if they make a kill, the predator eats it at the site it was killed.
Most of the time.
Eats it right there. Very rarely do they drag it off. If they do, you know, but even if they've got cubs, they bring the cubs there, unless it's a dangerous place that they have to take it. But so the idea of it storing up food doesn't make any sense for a creature that we know of now.
And people may not understand when we're talking about like poachers and stuff. Some guys kill the deer just for the rack, the antlers.
Yep.
They have no interest at all in the meat. Some other hunters are only interested in certain cuts, like they may cut out the back straps, yep, something like that, and leave the rest. And so, yeah, if you're illegally poaching, you might like try to hide the evidence.
Yeah, just throw them off in a
pile.
Knows? But I don't know. It's strange.
Very strange.
Okay. A few episodes ago, you remember I covered a story about a woman in Pennsylvania that saw this flying creature that she said was the size of her vehicle.
How could I forget?
Right. Well, we've got another one. This is again from Cryptozoology News. Yes.
See, so maybe there's something going on there.
Yeah, there might be.
Maybe it's all the same thing.
This past Wednesday, a Pennsylvania man claims that he saw a lizard-like bird in Lehigh County. 47-year-old construction worker said he was outside cutting firewood for his fireplace when this, what he calls the unusual creature, showed up. Now, okay, this is now he says this. Look, now he's telling everybody like a week later. So this is all on a Monday. This is a last Monday whenever he saw this in the afternoon.
Right. Okay.
Okay. And this is what he had to say. A large shadow appeared above me. I ran inside to grab my phone, but by the time I came outside, the bird was gone. I've been terrified to go outside since that event. Now, he actually does a drawing, and you can go to Cryptozoology News, and you can see the drawing. I would suggest on not doing that because it looks really like their kindergartners could do better. Like this guy's not an artist.
The guy's not artistic.
Dude,
okay.
Not at dude. It's bad.
Not everybody's Van Gogh.
Well, he needs to Van Gogh learn some art, but this is dude. It's not good. I'm just
he's
telling
a carpenter,
you.
Right? He's a construction worker.
Well, he should have built it out of wood or whatever he's doing because the drawing is rough.
Why are you hating? Hate.
I'm not hating. Hate. I'm just trying to save our listeners. That you want to go see it? Go ahead. But I'm telling you. You're not going to learn much from it, okay? But he says this, that this flying animal, he said, was a green bird.
The Gien-Gien Goblin.
The Gien-Gien Goblin with a 20-foot wingspan and said it was fully covered in scales.
Oh.
Now, he says, and this is a quote, it also had a spike on the end of its tail. And I love this quote because this is what everybody always says. I don't know why they add this. And razor-like talons.
But.
And he said, that it resembled a lizard.
Well, say this doesn't sound like a dinosaur. This sounds like a dragon.
It does sound
something
like a dragon.
Something like Daenerys, yeah. What's her name?
Targaryen.
Targaryen would be riding on.
That's right. Little Targaryen. Yeah, the Khaleesi comes in there. Like the Khaleesi was in Pennsylvania.
I've been waiting for that battle. I've been waiting for that battle.
35 years.
12 years. Yeah. I feel like I'm part of the Night's Watch. I've been waiting so damn long for winter to get here. Like when, it's the last season, they announced it. I'm like, when's the winter coming?
It's been going a long time. Winter's been coming for a long time. Now it's finally here.
Yeah, I'm,
all this buildup, it's going to let me down.
Yeah.
All this buildup, it'll be like done in two episodes. You're going to be like,
well, yeah, they said that like it's going to be 2 years and there's going to be six episodes. I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. They cannot wrap all this up in six episodes. How is that possible?
Unless each episode's 3 hours long, but
they better be. Don't you? I've been waiting. I mean, I wasted my time with True Blood. It was really good for about four seasons, and then it lost me.
It just fell apart.
Anyways, yeah. Continue. I'm sorry.
That's it. That was just what he's saying is it was a scaly, it looked like a lizard, a flying lizard.
Well, I have no rational explanation for what the guy saw.
If you had an irrational explanation, what would it be?
I would think that the guy was, just got off of work, probably had a
this
couple
is
Meister brows.
That's irrational. You're being rational. I said irrational.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
It was a flying
dragon.
Dragon. That's what it was.
Back to Justin's second story. Check this out. It says, in college back in 2012.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. We got double stories from this fella.
He sent us two stories.
Nice.
And I have something I'll tell you at the end of this one. He says, back in college, back in 2012, I was really big into horror movies, and I wanted to make my own film. I was enrolled in acting classes and was taking video principal courses as electives. I did a few short films with other students, and one day decided I was going to make my own feature film, even though I didn't really know where to begin. So I decided to do some research and find something scary. I stumbled upon the Black Eyed Kid stories. They were terrifying, and there were no other films out there about them. So right away, I knew that this was the movie I needed to make. So I purchased a bunch of gear, I recruited some acting buddies for actors and actresses, and then began writing my script. I was living in the basement of my grandparents' house while I was in college, and my grandparents were retired and would take long vacation trips to different places. I would get the house all to myself sometimes, and I would use this time to work on my projects. Well, one night, they were off on vacation, and I decided to work on my script. So I was in the basement, in bed, with my laptop. I was working on the script, and about 30 minutes in, I began to hear knocking on one of the basement windows. It was repetitive and consistent. It freaked me out a little bit, but I figured there was some explanation and that my mind was just playing tricks on me. I decided to take a break from writing and jumped on YouTube for some comedy to get my mind off the Black Eyed Kid stories. Well, about a few hours later, I was ready to get back to work on my script. This is 1 a.m. in the morning, and I'm back on my writing software, and I started working on the script. About 5 minutes in, the knocking returned. It was slightly louder and repetitive. I turned off my laptop and hunkered down into my blanket like a little kid. The knocking went on for about 10 minutes or so before it stopped. So, was this in my head or did this really happen? Something I had to ask myself, and a common theme with the black-eyed kids. It appears the more you look into them, the higher your chances of having an encounter. Something I never want. I incorporated the theme into the film, and I was able to finish it, but I was only able to do research and write during the day. I eventually brushed off the experience and finished the film. So, thanks, Justin, for that. And if you're wondering, the guy did make this film. You can go on Amazon, Amazon Prime. If you have Amazon Prime Video, you can go over there and you can watch this film. It's called Black Eyed Children, Let Me In. And I'll put links to it in the show notes. He says it's not the best film ever, but, you know, he made it in college and he made the whole film for under $1,000.
That's pretty cool.
So, and it is pretty cool. And he's 100% right. He attached a bunch of photos from the film and things like that. But we've talked about that before in the show. Some of these subjects, it's like the more you research them or look into them, you start having experiences. So, like, I've been the same place, Justin. I've been alone at night, up late, because, you know, the kids can't really do much work until they go to bed.
And you were doing a lot of blow back in the day.
Lots of cocaine, nose candy, dandruff. And you're up at night, and it's dark. Everyone's asleep, and you're reading and researching some very spooky things. Yeah, your mind can definitely...
Starts freaking yourself out.
Starts freaking with you, yeah. And you're just like, nah, I'm going to bed. But thanks for those stories. That was pretty cool.
That was great stuff. I've got you one here that Lon had posted, and I have to share it because it's something that we get messaged on all the time. Talk about what might be the fae folk, and this one jumped out at me. It's titled A Mimic in the Woods, and he said he received this, and I'm going to read this to y'all. It says, this incident occurred sometime in the fall of 2006. I grew up in a rural part of Ohio. My house had fairly dense woods located directly behind it. As a child, I had a passion for exploring. I especially loved exploring those woods. It was my favorite place to be. Prior to this incident, I had wandered through those woods many times, always with my mother's permission. There was one tree in particular that I frequently enjoyed to climb, usually about to the halfway mark so I could perch myself on one of the heavier branches and just relax as I listened to the peaceful sounds of nature. Climbing that tree for the very first time was quite an accomplishment. From that position, I could partially see the back of my house. On that day, after a fair amount of exploring, I carefully scaled my favorite tree. I seated myself on a sturdy branch and took in the view. Naturally, being late in October, the sun inevitably began to set within a few minutes. I always felt like a little saddened to see the darkness approaching. The woods were like my own little sanctuary. I could entertain myself out there for hours. When darkness began to fall, however, my mother would stand at the edge of the woods and call my name until I obediently returned home so not to be stranded out there after dark. After watching the sunset until I could no longer see it, I began my descent down the tree. I was nearly at the bottom when I heard my mother's familiar voice calling my name. I thought nothing of it at first, as this routine had occurred plenty of times before. Then I realized something strange as my feet touched the ground. My mother's voice was coming from behind me, deeper in the woods, rather than towards the entrance where she had always stood when she called me home. My mom had never entered those woods before, at least not with me. I was eager to find her and show her all of my favorite spots before it grew too dark. Now that's when I realized something was off. How could she have gone into the woods ahead of me? Certainly I could have missed her, but as I said, she never entered those woods. She continued calling my name, but there was something strange about it. She sounded absolutely frantic, almost angry. Fearing that I was in trouble for reasons currently unknown, I just froze in place. As her voice drew closer, I squinted my eyes to see if I could locate her and determine exactly how angry or upset she appeared to be. Now, however, I didn't see anyone or anything unusual. Suddenly, I heard her voice calling my name from the direction of my house, sounding much calmer. Seconds later, from somewhere in the woods yet again, it wasn't an echo, and I wasn't imagining things. I was literally hearing her beckoning me from the edge of our backyard as well as ahead of me. My legs suddenly turned to jelly. I couldn't quite comprehend what was going on. "Come here right now!" The voice that I originally believed to be her screamed from just ahead. I realized that whoever or whatever was mimicking my mother was drawing closer. I didn't question which voice was actually my mother's, as there was something about the way it sounded that unnerved me. Terrified of what I would see if I stood there much longer, I turned around and ran towards the exit of the woods as quickly as my legs could possibly carry me. It was amazing that I didn't trip over anything in my haste. Even though my home wasn't very far from where I was, those woods had never seemed larger to me than it did in that moment. From behind me, my mother's voice continued to call my name, now sounding desperate. Panic set in as my actual mother finally came into view, waiting patiently, as she usually did until I returned home. Now, in my frightened state, I absolutely refused to look back. As soon as I was out of the woods and in the backyard next to my mother, the other voice was suddenly gone. Now, rather than fading away, it seemed to stop the very moment I stepped foot into my backyard. I must have looked as frightened as I felt because my mother asked me instantly what was wrong. Slowly but surely, my panic subsided. I didn't say anything until we were safely inside the house with our doors locked. I asked my mother if she had ever entered the woods. Appearing confused by the question, she told me that of course she hadn't. With that confirmation, I hesitantly asked her if she had heard anyone else calling my name and yelling. The answer to that question was also no. Although I was still very much shaken up, I managed to explain everything that happened as clearly and rationally as possible. My mother was surprisingly nonchalant about the whole situation, explaining that I must have just imagined it, that I was spending too much time out there by myself. The incident in those woods have stayed with me to this day. I can still hear that voice as clear as a bell. Whoever or whatever it was calling my name sounded exactly like my mother. But I know it wasn't her. Not only was she waiting for me outside, but the voice also sounded strange in a way that I can't fully explain. I didn't go back into the woods until I was 17 years old, and even then, I never hung out for very long. I've carefully gone over every possible explanation, but none of them seem entirely plausible. It certainly wasn't my mother playing a prank. There was no way she could have pulled it off, not to mention the fact that she's never been one to play pranks. I also highly doubt that it was anyone else because, as I stated before, we lived in a rural area. The closest neighbor was at least a mile away, and I wasn't personally acquainted with any of them. How could they have known my name and where to find me? Now, we've moved out of the house, but my mother and I occasionally discuss the incident. She still claims that she never heard or saw anything unusual out there. I know it probably shouldn't, but what happened in those woods continues to bother me. I spent many hours out there prior to that day and never had anything out of the ordinary occur. The best explanation I have at this point is a doppelganger or possibly a demon, but I'm unsure. If anyone has a possible explanation as to what might have happened, I'd love to hear it. Thank you for reading, A.W. Right then, reading it, when he talks about the mimic in the woods, it makes me think of fae folk. It instantly feels like it's fae, some mischievous brownie or something, trying to call to get him to come in.
Well, that's what a puckwudgie does, right? It's in the woods and it kind of lures you into your own demise. Yes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So how, it's kind of wild, right? It's a very, very wild thing. But Ohio is known for being weird and wacky and wild and having some really strange things go down.
Yeah.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, I'm going to discuss some adventurous animals, if you will, something strange and unusual, but it's going to involve the animals. This is going to be a fun, kind of lighthearted show, nothing too dark. There is going to be a little bit of some wild stuff with these animals. Some of them have been in the military, but it's not going to be one of those heavy shows. This is going to be a good one to kick off the week. So let's take a quick break and we'll jump back into it when we get back. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. All right, my friends, we are back. And look, this is something that I have to blame on my supervisor at work for Christmas. He got me a book and it has a bunch of like little crazy trivia and crazy stuff that goes on. And it's not like a little book, like this son of a gun's like War and Peace thick, you know, and it's got all kinds of wild tales and just funny stuff that goes on it. And I flip it open and the first whole chapter of it is all about animals and wild stuff and funny stuff that's happened with animals. And I flip it open on the very first page, this came up and I had forgotten all about what I'm about to talk to you about. So let me set the stage. When I was a young child, I started kindergarten through fourth grade. I was in a town west of here, not in West Texas, a little town called Ranger, Texas. Now, as I was in that town, there was about 3,000 people. It has since dropped, I think there's like 2,300, 2,400 or whatnot. But I mean, so it's definitely not gotten bigger. All it is like a little oil town that used to be around the whole thing, but it was, you know, it's an old town. And they have like a decent baseball team and stuff like that. The junior college out there does things like this. But I mean, it's a very small West Texas little town that you could imagine. And just west of it, not even, I think, less than 18 miles, something like that. It's not far, maybe 20 miles west of it, is a town called Eastland. And Eastland's a little bit bigger, of course, but Eastland's a little bit nicer town and all this. Well, back in 1897, when Eastland was building their courthouse, they had a cornerstone, like most all courthouses do. They always put something in it, you know, like they do this for prosperity's sake. So you can break it open like a time capsule, right?
Right.
So in 1897, they put some stuff in there. Well, they put a horned toad. Now, for those that don't know, we call them horny toads here in Texas. They used to be everywhere. If you don't know what they look like, look them up. They look like little tiny dragons. I mean, it's
the mascot for the TCU.
Yeah. And so they put one in there, in that cornerstone back in 1897. Well, nobody thinks they put it in there, you know, because they were everywhere. When I grew up, they were literally everywhere. You don't see many of them as you do now. I mean,
I think fire ants destroyed them.
Yeah, it's hard to find them. Like, I was finding them up in Northwest Texas and whatnot, up in the panhandle stuff, you'd see them. But it was hard to find them. So back then, they've got them and all this stuff. They were everywhere, so they put it in there. Well, in February of 1928, they were going to rebuild the courthouse. So they were going to tear it all down. So they were like, well, I'll tell you what, let's go ahead and let's open the old cornerstone. So that's what they do. Over 3,000 people show up into Eastland that day, February 18th to be exact, in 1928. 31 years after being placed in that cornerstone, they crack it open, tear it out. There's the stuff in there. They break open the whole deal. And there's what they ended up naming him, Old Rip. And this horny toad comes alive. Comes out of whatever suspended animation or hibernation or whatever it was that he was in. This horny toad, Old Rip, was still alive in there. Now, there is a quote from a resident back then named Cecil Funderburg or Funderburg, and he talks about this. And his quote was, a crowd of about 3,000 people gathered together for the opening of the cornerstone because there were rumors that the horned toad could live for 100 years. You know, could hibernate for 100 years, and everybody wanted to see if it was true. So after 31 years, they opened the cornerstone, and an oil man by the name of Eugene Day reached into the cornerstone and pulled out a flat, dusty, horned toad, handed it to the Methodist preacher, who then handed it to the county judge, Judge Pritchard. Judge Pritchard held it up by the hind leg for everybody to see, and all of a sudden, the other hind leg started twitching. Then he took a deep breath and he puffed up like a horned toad will sometimes puff up pretty good. And the crowd went crazy, you know. And that's the story. So it doesn't stop there. Old Rip gets super famous back in 1928. Everybody. And when I say everybody, I'm talking he starts going around the United States. They have him in a like a box, like an aquarium. They're taking around, letting everybody see him. I mean, everywhere. And you have to imagine, of course, back then. Cars are relatively brand new, you know, the idea of that. So they're touring them on trains, driving on cars. If you have a filling station, if you have any place that they could stop and show it, I'm sure people are paying a penny or a nickel, you know.
Right.
Who knows what they're paying to see it. The president at the time, President Coolidge, even went and saw Old Rip. Like, they took him to see the president. He gets to see the whole thing. Now, y'all are going to really get a kick out of this. 11 months after they took him out of the cornerstone, he dies. Yeah. Too much. It was just too much for him. So Old Rip didn't buff out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what do they do with him? Somebody builds him a little casket. So there's a casket, and it's velvet lined, and they take him, and they have him embalmed, and they put him in the little casket, and they put him on display in the courthouse, the new one that they'd built.
Okay? Right.
No big deal. All the way up until 1973. And in 1973, he was stolen. Somebody broke in, stole Old Rip. Well, he's gone crazy. People go nuts. They don't know what's happening. They have no idea. Well, a little while later, they get this a letter explaining just it was, you know, there was no name. There was nothing on it that the fella that had taken him felt really, really bad about it. And so he said, you know, he said, you know, look, we're going to come forward. This is the whole thing. You know, this is how it is, this whole thing. So they take it. And he said, this is where Old Rip's going to be. and they put him at the county fairgrounds there. And they go out there, and what do they find? They find old Rip, completely recovered. Now, some believe that the horned toad that's in the box now is fake, because they said this, that the one that's in the box now is fairly well preserved. They said the other one looked more mummified, right?
Uh-huh.
That's what they're talking about. But either way, this, that was kind of the idea behind it. So that being said, if you go to Eastland, Texas today, folks, because I saw it as a kid, we talked about it in school, it was one of those things that we grew up knowing about it. If you go to Eastland, Texas today, old Rip still on display in the window there. When you go into the courthouse, you can still go see him. Hmm. So he's still there. So 31 years of sitting around there. Also, too, do you remember the frog on the old, I can't remember which cartoon it was. I think it was Warner Brothers. But I remember the hello, my baby, hello, my darling, when it would always come back to life.
That was like the WB frog.
Okay, that was based on the story of old Rip.
Oh, okay.
So that's the whole idea behind that thing. Or at least that's what we ended up being told. Okay, so you talk about something crazy. We're going to get into something else a little wild with this. Philly, have you ever heard of Oscar the Hairy Angel of Death?
No.
Also known as the Therapy Cat.
No, I'm not, okay. I'm not aware of that.
You're going to like this.
And the frog's name was Michigan J. Frog.
There you go. There you go. There was a nursing home, all right? And this nursing home back in 2005 adopts this cat. And it's a gray and brown cat, medium-haired. Not the long, not the short, medium-haired cat, right?
Uh-huh.
The nursing home is called Steer House. And so they adopt it. And the reason they adopt this cat is because they want it to be more homey. Right. You think about it. Animals at a nursing home, especially more like a hospice home, is going, you kind of want it to be a little bit more homey that way. Well, Dr. David Dosa was working there at this time, and there's no way a geriatrician. So he works with old folks. OK, he's also a professor at Brown University, and he works on the third floor of Steer House. And that house, they treat patients with dementia. And not just like, I mean, like severe, like in their last days, those that can't recognize people, those that can't talk, right? So it's just all broken. And that's what they're there to treat. Well, he wrote a book, and the book is written, or the book is titled Making Rounds with Oscar, The Extraordinary Gift of an Ordinary Cat. Now, he is quoted in saying this, that Oscar was initially sort of a very scared cat. He said that he wouldn't really like to come out. He would keep to himself, and oftentimes you'd find him in a supply closet, he says, or he'd be under a bed somewhere. And it wasn't until, and I get a load of this, somebody was near death that Oscar would come out and come into front and center. Now, of course, you know, Dr. Dosa is scientifically minded because he's a doctor, and he's extremely skeptical when he first started hearing that Oscar, this nursing home cat, could predict patients' deaths. At least a lot, because he would show up, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this cat would lay beside them, lay on them, lay with them for their final hours of their life. Well, Dosa worked there with these other colleagues and made these rounds, Dosa did, with knowing Oscar was there for 5 years. And he tallied up 50 correct calls, this cat did, of when it was. Yeah, 50. Now, I believe it ended up being more than that total up to this point in time, okay? Like, but this is the time that Dosa was studying it scientifically, was trying to keep up with, does he ever pick one that doesn't? Or does, you know what I mean? Is like, how does he pick them? Is it just, who knows how it is? But it wasn't. This is what he kept going on. It said that over this time that Oscar would come out of hiding, he would go find the patient that was dying, and that he would climb up on them and purr and rub, and like he's, it's almost like he was trying to comfort and cuddle with these people there towards the end. And Dr. Dosa explains this. He said, we would eventually find out after he did this several times that the people he was staying with were usually the next ones to go. One death occurred, then two deaths, and ultimately hit about 20 or 30 deaths in a row, at which point everyone started to say, wow, this is something unique. So right there, he's hitting them in a row. Now, he goes on to say that people were actually taking great comfort in this idea that this animal was there and might be there when their loved ones passed. Says, especially those people that he could be there whenever the loved ones couldn't be there.
Right.
So they say a year after this, you know, this is after a year or so that the staff noticed that after, so I guess say in 2006, the staff started noticing that he would pace from room to room. And what was funny is that he would walk up and he would sniff and look in the room, but he wouldn't spend much time with anybody until he, like these patients were dying in the last few hours of their life. And they said that he got so accurate at this that the doctor himself, Dosa, and all the other staff said that when Oscar would climb up on the bed and stretch out beside the members of the people that they thought might be passing away, they would call the family and said, "You need to get in here. Your loved one's passing.
Wow.
You need to come in here." And they said, get a load of this, that if they closed the door and tried to keep Oscar out, he would sit at the door and scratch and paw under the door until you opened it to let him in, like he had to come in. Now, they even have a story of this. They said one time one of the patients was gravely ill, like death's door. So the nurse grabs Oscar, brings Oscar in. Oscar didn't come. She brought Oscar in. Oscar wouldn't stay. He'd get down and go run around and do other stuff. They're like, well, this one's over. You know, no. No.
What a bizarre story. I mean, I've heard of dogs, certain dogs, being able to smell cancer like an impatient. Yep. That's strange, man.
Well, here's what this is. They kept saying, and they're like, well, now he's got one wrong. No, he didn't get one wrong. The patient was fine. He ended up dying 2 days later. And then 2 days later, Oscar showed back up and laid with him. So they were trying to force Oscar to this patient. Wasn't happening. So people go on. I believe it's up to over. Now, of course, I believe he's still alive. What I looked into, I believe he's still, you know, this old cat's still alive and still doing it. Now he has over 100 of these things confirmed of patients passing away. Now, it's believed, like you're talking about smelling, they don't know for a fact if it's a smell that we emit hours before we pass, like it's something that our body starts secreting and that he picks up on it. And that's what I said. I need to get the book and read Dr. Dosa's book about it, because it's a really interesting thing. But it's funny, they called him a therapy cat, but other people would joke and call him the hairy angel of death, because when he showed up, you weren't going to make it. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, that's it.
That's crazy.
And now, so it doesn't even stop there. Well, I guess it does stop there with Oscar. So I got to looking at animals used in the military. Now, you remember we had talked one time with Nick Redfern, and he was talking about cats that were used for, I believe it was in Russia, when they were trying to put them in the embassy, and where they could put like devices on them where you could hear.
Like a bug or
like
something.
Like a bug, yeah. And then they tried to do it with rats and all this stuff. Well, that wasn't the only time. Back in the 1960s, and we've discussed this before, the Navy started doing studies with dolphins. Remember us talking about this?
Yeah, I remember that.
And so they would go through it. It was the U.S. Navy Marine Mammal Program, and that was in 1967. And they started training them to be a minesweeper. So they were going out looking for mines. So they would mine hunt, and these dolphins could locate these mines underwater. And then when they would get there, they were trained to release buoys where these mines were to float up, and then the Navy could come along there and clear them out. Now, you're going to get a kick out of this. During the Iraqi war in 2003, dolphins helped clear 100 miles of the port of Qusair, I guess is how you pronounce this. So, and also, they trained them to guard against enemy divers. So they were trained, I guess maybe they had a noise, something that would emit sound that the dolphins would hear. And then if you weren't wearing it, they would go and, I guess, circle and alert like dogs. You could train a dolphin to do basically the thing as a dog. So they said that when the diver would approach, a dolphin was trained to get it to bump a buoy device onto the person's back, which would, so I guess it would try to plant something on it, like the dolphin's going to stick something on you and it would open up. So you imagine this, you're swimming in the darkness, a dolphin comes racing up and sticks something on your body and swims away and it blows up and you float to the top. So you're fighting to get this buoy off. Now this is back in 2003. So this isn't like some crazy harebrained World War II scheme like we're going to discuss in some of these. So you do dolphins. You've got dolphins doing minesweeping, which, I mean, they're smart.
Very.
I mean, they're super duper smart. So you would think, yeah, that's probably the best thing to use is a dolphin. So you think, well, what else are we going to need? Well, then the U.S. Navy Marine Mammal Program also started working with sea lions. Now this is what they would do. And get a load of this. They were even cross-trained to work with the dolphins. Sea lions and dolphins working together.
Wow.
And that they would help protect the U.S. harbor installations, the ships, and also against enemy divers. And this is what I like, that they said if there was equipment that was dropped from a ship or a plane, that these sea lions were excellent divers and that they could outperform human divers in recovery and retrieval of some of these things. And that the very first time they used them was in November of 1970. They used a sea lion to recover an anti-submarine rocket from 180 foot deep.
Wow.
Now, how crazy is that?
That is crazy.
So now you've got dolphins and you got sea lions, all this wild stuff going on in the ocean. First of all, I can't imagine. I don't know. It just seems crazy to me. It seems wrong, if that makes sense. It seems wrong to use an animal in a combat sense like that. Like, it's one thing to have a dog and, you know, and you got combat dogs on the field and all this, you know, but to use, and I don't know why it feels that way, but yeah, I got you another one. I don't know. You're going to really, really enjoy this. This was developed by the United States back in World War II, and they were going to use it against Japan. And what they were looking to do was to drop hundreds of these bombs over Osaka Bay in Japan. And they said that these cities were largely, of course, at the time, constructed of what? Wooden paper, right? Yeah. It's the way these Japanese buildings and cities were set up. So they were like, well, how can we, and we don't want to drop, like, you know, the atomic bomb on them. Let's try something a little bit, you know, because we talk about the firebombing that went on all through over there was terrible. And that's the reason it was firebombing, is because of what the buildings were made of. Right. It was easy to cast fire. So some fella comes forward and is like, I got an idea. This is what we're going to do. We're going to build a bomb that has 26 trays. And each one of those trays is going to hold 40 sleeping bats. And each one of these bats is going to have an incendiary device on it. And we're going to set those timers on those incendiary devices and put those bats sleeping in that tray. And when it goes down and we drop this bomb, it's going to have a parachute. And this bomb is going to open up from the bottom and it's going to parachute down and these bats are all going to fly out. Well, then what's going to happen? They're going to look for places to roost for the night. So all these bats are going to fly into these houses and into these warehouses. And then this incendiary device is going to go off and blow up and blow fire, destroying the bat and catching fire to all these villages. So we're going to have bat bombs. Now, of course, everybody knows they didn't use bat bombs. They used the atomic bomb. But who has the idea of we're going to build flaming bats to drop out of a plane?
A madman.
A crazy person, right? So, we've got sea lions, we've got dolphins, and we've got fire-breathing, if you will, bats, or flaming bats. So, the next best step would be on the battlefield. What would we do? We're going to have to use man's best friend. Now, like you and I have talked about, you've got dogs for hunting. You've got dogs for, you know, being a friend and a pal. The police use them. The military use them and all this. So the Soviets decide, heck, we're going to get in on this whole thing. So during World War II, the Russians thought, you know what? We got this. The Nazi army is advancing into the Russian territory. And, you know, we've talked about this before. You and I have discussed this off air, you know, extensively, is talking about the tanks that the Germans used. The Americans didn't know how to deal with them. The Soviets didn't know how to deal with them. It was amazing how well they were built.
Right. The Panzers and the Tiger tanks.
Yes. And they're like, what are we going to be able to do? So the Russians said, well, we know what we got to do. The one place that a tank is always the weakest is under the belly. It's just the way it is. It's always built to be the outside because the earth protects it underneath. It's hard to get something up underneath it. So they're like, well, that's what we're going to do. We're going to train dogs to place bombs underneath enemy tanks. So they want to have a dog put a bomb in the front of a tank and then run back to safety. That's what they wanted to do. So they start working on that. Well, it's way harder than you think to have a dog run in there, put something down, leave it, and run back and be safely back before you can detonate the explosive device and stop the tank, okay?
Right.
It's just not going to happen. So they said, well, we got something better. We're going to build a vest. We're going to fill it with explosives, and we're going to put a lever sticking off the top, and we're going to train these dogs to run underneath a tank, and that lever is going to get knocked down when they run underneath it, and it's going to detonate it, and it's going to blow up the dog and underneath the tank in the chassis and disable the tank.
Yeah, PETA wouldn't like that.
No. So that's what they did. They start teaching and training dogs to do this. Now, there is some paperwork that the Soviets have found, you know, that people have come out and all this stuff and did some digging and some researching. And the Soviets claimed that this worked so well that they not just disabled, but destroyed 300 German tanks by dogs setting off the bombs.
This actually worked.
That's what they claim. But others that have looked into it said, I don't think it worked that way, because you have to train a dog on scent. They're going to scent, not going to attack a tank, because a tank to them, they don't know there's a tank and a truck. So they're trained on scent.
I could only picture like a video with like Sarah McLachlan playing in the background. Yes. As these dogs ran
the arms
in there
of an angel when they go in and just blow up. Yeah. So they said, well, what do you train them on? Well, you don't have any German tanks. You train them on Soviet tanks. Only trouble is German tanks ran on what? Gasoline. Soviet tanks, like American tanks, ran on what?
Diesel.
All right. So they said that while they were doing it, you had to be real careful because they would run out, circle back, and run underneath the Soviet tank.
Like, no. No, spot, yeah. Go the other way.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
Blowing a dog whistle.
Yeah, you're like, no. Imagine that. You're like, oh, no. And then here, it makes me think of The Hunt for Red October. When they shoot the rocket, they do all the fancy stuff, and it comes right back and hits them. And the guy looks, he goes, Captain, you've killed us all.
Yeah, he pulled a crazy Ivan.
It misses them, and the whole thing blows them up. But that's it. So they're like, but it shows, I mean, how crazy one man is, how, you know, how wild are you wanting to go?
Yeah.
That's what it is. But the wildest part is this is some military claims that they kept using this anti-tank program that they had set up training dogs all the way up until 1996.
Wow.
So undoubtedly they had some success with the whole thing.
Yeah, who would think?
That brings me to, I'm like, well, if we're going to go small, we've got bats, we got stuff in the water. We got dolphins and sea lions. We got man's best friend. What else could you use? Well, we've always heard of these stories of Hannibal and Alexander the Great using what? Elephants.
Right.
Elephants in the military. Well, of course, it goes all the way back into India, but they were elephants. It wasn't a strange thing to have an elephant in the military back then. That was just something that it was. They were called war elephants. They were always in the center of the line, and they would train, you know, like we've seen them in Thailand. We've seen the way these elephants would start running, and they can run close to 20, between 15 and 20 miles an hour. Well, imagine being stampeded and trampled by, how are you going to bring that down? Especially then, you got bows and arrows, spears. It's going to take some work. Also, you can only imagine too, how much they can carry. So there's no tanks, right?
Right.
There's no way of moving. I mean, the logistics of moving this stuff. So what do? You built big sleds or big wagons, and then you had the elephants pull that, and then you weighted the elephants down with it, and they just took off with all that stuff. And they said, but horses, like the cavalry that are like horseback back then, what was the problem with them? A spear wall. You couldn't ride horses, like when you're charging a horse into it.
Right.
A horse, first of all, the horses would panic that much. They would freak them out, stuff in their face, you know, and all this. People, it's documented how hard it was when they finally realized that they could build the big spear walls and lift them up and stop the cavalry. Well, they said elephants didn't have that fear. So they would ride those elephants into those spear walls. Said most of the spears, yeah, it may stick them in there, but it wouldn't really hurt them that bad. And they would use their trunks to just start swinging and just knocking the spears and the soldiers out of the way. And the elephants just walk right through a line of warriors. You think, how would you get one down? Elephant, it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of cutting to stop him. And you're not talking about, you're not just fighting the elephant, you're fighting the guys coming with him.
Right, yeah.
So it's one of those things. And they said that back in those days that an elephant, the charging line of elephants that they would use, was enough just to see them to cause many of the other warring side to just break rank and run, because they're like, dude, we don't have anything to stop it.
They got dinosaurs on their team.
Yeah, like, dude, we're done. We don't have anything to stop it. It wasn't until the invention of a cannon that it started making it where they could take an elephant out. When they started using those old, you know, like the Chinese invented gunpowder, we got our hands on it, you know, we start making all these cannons and they start finding all this. It wasn't until then that it would slow it down, because they said it was even that deal. You could shoot them with a musket back in those days. It wouldn't do anything. A musket fire, I mean, how are you going to kill an elephant with an old musket round, even an old 50 cal?
Right.
Like, yeah. It may go in an inch, 2 inches, 3 inches. Like, yeah, it's going to kill whitetail. It's going to kill, but an elephant?
Right.
Like, yeah. It's not going to kill an elephant. High-powered rifles, the calibers we have today, lots of them won't kill an elephant.
If you use, like, a 500 Holland and Holland or something.
600 Nitro Express. Yeah. Although there was stories of a guy that used to hunt them back in the 50s for the African government. He used a 243. Shoot them behind the ear. He'd catch them walking away and shoot him back in the back of the head.
Wow.
Some way to try to snake it in there and put him down. But
he probably studied the skull and saw like an opening.
Because the top of it is all honeycombed. There's not a lot. Where you think the brain is and where it actually is isn't the same.
Yeah.
So when you shoot him in the top of the head, it would just go right through a hollow spot and then you get your gut stomped out. Pretty much the way it worked. So you've got to imagine this. Still the whole thing. The cannon was the only thing that slowed down the use of elephants. But you want me to tell you something even wilder than that?
Please.
In 1987... in Kirkuk, in Iraq, the story goes that the Iraqi troops were using elephants to move heavy weaponry, to move, like, I guess, anti-aircraft guns,
right.
Whatever they had, they were using elephants back then to move them and drag them around.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of countries still rely on elephants to do a lot of heavy work.
But how wild
like
is that?
Like in Thailand, and Vietnam and stuff.
Yeah, that they have them in a war elephant. Like, you see them, what's the big war elephants in? It's in The Lord of the Rings. Remember, they got all the on their tusks and stuff, have all that. It's that kind of thing. But of course, they weren't that big. I mean, only imagine. So there were war elephants. Well, if you have war elephants, you have to have, and you didn't have a cannon, you have to have a way of defeating a war elephant. The only way of defeating a war elephant
is a mouse.
Mice. Is with a flaming pig.
Really?
Yes. The stories go that the squealing sound that a burning hog makes. And the fact that the way they ran, these pigs would just run in herds and just squeal and dart around, would freak an elephant out so bad.
It'd freak me out.
Yeah. It is said that the Romans and Alexander the Great, in their warring campaigns, when their enemies had war elephants, would use this. They would take pigs. Now, this is actually from the notes called Beast of War. It says this is Antagonus II's Gonata's siege of Megara in 266 BC was broken when the Megarians doused pigs with a combustible pitch of crude oil or resin. So basically they're making napalm and covering pigs with it. Then they would set them on fire and run herds of screaming, squealing pigs towards the war elephants.
Man, you guys smell bacon.
Right? I'm like, I'm thinking it makes me hungry. First of all, how horrible is that? It's like, this is what you're gonna do. We're just gonna burn our pigs.
Yeah, because pigs
you're gonna
are
burn
so,
a pig alive just skin, to run an elephant off.
Their skin and everything is so much like a human.
So much like ours.
And pigs are sweet animals.
I've got a grand pig. My son's got Scooter. He's had forever.
Yeah.
My grand pig. Yeah, I can't imagine setting Scooter on fire. We were hanging out just 2 weeks ago. And I was giving him stuff for Christmas. I mean, it's my grand pig. So I mean, what am I gonna do?
But you know,
I threaten to make him into a sandwich all the time when he acts up, but I mean, he just looks at me with those squinty eyes. But I can't look. But this is a different time. This is 266 BC. So apparently what would happen was it would turn these charging elephants would be turned back and these burning pigs would run into the ranks of the men. OK.
Yeah.
So not only is that, it's catching other things on fire because it's a burning greased hog, smearing burning oil and whatever they had else on them on you. So there's a chance of you catching your attacking lions on fire, and then your elephants are freaking out and turning and running. Well, then they're running over your own troops to get away from flaming pigs. Yeah. So that is just, look, I'm going to stop right there with the whole crazy. I have got some really crazy ones I'm going to cover on the Elite Show. Well, I say really crazy. They're like this, but there is some that I can go down now and give you the names where these actual military animals not only had crazy careers, but they had names. It wasn't like, oh, there's a bunch of pigs or there's a bunch of dolphins. No, there are some that were singled out as war heroes because of the things that they did and were actually became enlisted soldiers.
Wow.
Much like a police dog receives a police burial. You know, if he dies in the line of duty, he is treated just like a regular officer. That's the way these animals were back in like World War I, World War II, all these things. So there are some other really wild stories. I'm going to get into that in the next show this week. So we'll go ahead and take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap this puppy up. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Interesting stories. I know I say that all the time we get back from a break. There's probably a drinking game associated with it, but I've never even heard of some of these things. Like the bat bombs, I've never heard of that. Like the dolphins, you know, I've heard of those stories. I've definitely never heard about the elephants and stuff. So it's incredible that even dating to hundreds of thousands of years ago, people were incorporating the use of animals to help them during war.
Yes, yeah. Like I said, I've got a bunch of them I'm going to cover on the next show, on the Elite Show, that's, like I said, they've got names. They've got, I mean, it's, this is one of those things, like I told you, one thing led to the next, and then I was like, man, I want to look into this. And of course, you know, like I said, you and I have been watching live PD and watching the canines, and we have canines, our officers here have canines and all that stuff. But like you said, it's, you never think of it that far. Like we've heard about the dolphins or the cat, or you think about, like we said, the dog, you know, and all that, but you don't think about bat bombs.
No.
Or you don't think about dogs with explosive tied to their back to run under tanks. And like we said, we don't use elephants now, but elephants were used a lot back in the day because that was their tank. That's the best way they could use it. I mean, even in India, when they talk about it, they used to mount machine guns on them.
Wow.
They would have like big, you know, big 50 cals and whatnot. Like imagine the fact of like an old Browning, right? The old water-cooled Brownings that they would put in there. Now, a man couldn't care. Like you've seen... not Band of Brothers. What's the one that was in the Pacific? Is it called what was that one? Is it called the Pacific? I think it is. The other 10-part series that was like Band of Brothers, but it took place.
Was it on HBO?
Yes. It took place in
I don't think I saw that one.
It took place in the Japanese conflict. But in one part, it shows them they would issue a glove. So you could shoot your gun, even though it was, you know, cooled down, but then you had to pick that big son of a gun up and run around with it. They weren't made like they are now to be a little bit more mobile.
Right.
So you had to, you know, lock them into gunner's nest, and then if you abandoned them, you lost the gun. The enemy got it.
Right.
Right. Now imagine you've got an elephant, and you've got a machine gun mounted to the back of that elephant, and you're just lighting them up, just hot brass raining off an elephant as it's walking. I mean, it really, even to this day, it would be be in a post-apocalyptic movie. Is guys ought to have elephants that they've taken out of the zoos or something with machine guns mounted on them. Like, you're in trouble. You come like a normal dude. Like, if you don't have a explosive, like a cannon.
Right.
Even today, like, how are you going to fight one? Like, you're not.
Yeah, I don't
you're
know.
You're not going to beat an elephant unless you got a flaming pig. And I'd never heard of the idea of lighting a pig on fire.
Right. Well, speaking of scary animals, I just saw an article today about... apparently an area in southeast Brazil, it's raining spiders. That's right.
Ken,
they said that when temperatures get just right and it's really humid, this happens quite a bit where it appears that there's spiders, millions upon millions of eight-legged visitors that are raining down on the public. And they said what it really is that they're not really raining down. Apparently these are social spiders. And when it gets really hot out, for whatever reason, they work together collectively. And they spin these massive webs, and the webs are so thin and small, minute, that you can't really see the web. So it gives the illusion that the sky is raining with spiders. And if you look at some of the films of it, it looks like there's tiny dots all over the sky, and it's just a ginormous web. There's videos and people that they were interviewing people in the article where, like, you'd be just walking down the road and all of a sudden spiders will just start dropping out of the sky on you.
How much would you love that?
It's another reason why I'll never go to Brazil. The Amazon terrifies me, right? From the bullet ants to the anaconda. Oh, snakes don't get that big.
Yeah. Oh, they don't.
You know, I'm just never going to go down there. They have the jujitsu with the made-up records. You know, it's just a shady culture, I think.
With spiders. See, I would believe, I don't know why Brazil, I'm like, yeah, if it was Australia, I would believe it.
Well, yeah, those, it would be like raining deadliest spiders known to man would be falling on you.
Yeah.
Yeah, Australia is a dangerous place, but so is Brazil. I mean, Brazil has some major cities, but outside of that, it looks like it's still pretty wild.
Yeah, I think so.
I watch a lot of shows and documentaries where people go to the Amazon and they're looking for medicinal plants, or sometimes they're trying to help out villagers. I've even seen Steve Rinella go down there on a hunting show, and he's like, you know,
he got bit by the bullet ant.
Man, it's just like, that's not for me. And the insects, can you imagine the amount of insects in that forest at night, in that jungle? It's not really a forest, but...
Well, I've thought about that because I know which episode of Steve's you're talking about on Meat Eater, and I thought about that whole thing is... I mean, we've stayed the night sometimes in certain places down on the river when you stay the night on the summertime.
Yeah.
Whatnot, and it's loud with bugs. I can't imagine the sound in that. It would be deafening. Like, you watch those documentaries at night, and it is just the noise of insects is deafening.
And the snakes,
sound.
The venomous snakes.
Yeah.
There's giant jaguars. I mean,
I would like to be bit by a bullet ant.
All right, I'm sure we can set that up.
I would like to know what that feels like. It's supposed to be the top of the Schmidt pain index, right? The pain scale.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the bullet ants the top? But like he was talking about, like an hour after it happened, he couldn't even tell you which leg he got bit on.
Yeah,
he was like, but the first hour was horrible,
excruciating.
But I want to know what it feels like, because I've been bit by all kinds of wasps and stung by, you know, we're talking about with scorpions and all kinds of stuff, and I would like to see what. I don't want to be bit by something like rattlesnakes, going to make your flesh fall off, but like a bullet ant bite, yeah, I'd like to see what that feels like.
And what's interesting with Steve Rinella on his show is, like, they were asking him about like, do the bugs seem to bother the locals, and I guess the locals are so used to getting stung and bitten, like, pretty much continuously, that it, like, has no effect
on. Yeah, he said they don't pay any attention to it. Now, they still put stuff on some kind of plant that they
pull
up. Yeah,
but you know what I mean.
But, yeah, he's like, they don't swat it. It's not like something we're constantly
fighting
off. We
would be miserable, and they would be like, nah, it's fine.
When a mosquito bites you, do you bump up?
Sometimes.
I don't. I've never.
Sometimes I do.
I think
it's more if I keep messing with it, it will.
When my wife or my daughter gets bit, it leaves little bumps on them. Hmm. You know, like it looks almost like a little chigger or a bug bite.
Yeah.
If they
prefer to be called chigros. Go ahead.
If it bites me, there's not even a mark. I can't even tell you where a mosquito bit me.
Yeah.
I've never had that. Like, I've seen, like, their backs, like you go camping and people's backs and all.
No, it's interesting.
But not those. Mosquitoes just don't. I don't know why.
I don't remember the guy's name that Steve was hanging out with that was kind of his tour guide, the villager there. But he was explaining
it was him and his brother.
That they were getting great amusement out of the suffering he was going through. And so he was like, well, if I can get your visa passed, he wants to take them up to Alaska.
Ice fishing.
Because he wants to show them that, like, they'll be miserable and he'll be totally fine. Like, I'm used to this. Doesn't bother me.
That's what and I understand that. Yeah, like, he wants them to view him the same way he views them.
Yeah, exactly. In awe, right? That's what he says. Yeah.
And like, I love how that's what I love about Steve is he's very honest.
Yes.
He's very honest. And like, he talks about, he wants them to do well, but he doesn't want them to do so well that they lose the mystique of being in the woods. Like, he talked about, what are you, 7-8 years ago, the first time he went, he tried to tell them about the sunglasses, you know, the polarized
glasses.
Fish.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have it. He said he goes back 5 years later and they're all wearing it.
They all got them. Yeah.
He's like, I like it, but then again, it kind of hurts my feelings. You know?
Yeah, because,
like,
he doesn't want to see the time.
I don't
want
to see a change. Yeah, I want it to see be the same thing.
You know, if you're on the fence about hunting, I couldn't recommend a guy better to watch, because he really shows you what hunting, you know, of course, the way it's supposed to be done. Look, there's a lot of boneheads out there that are hunters that are terrible for the sport. But he has, his show's name is Meat Eater. They have it on the Hunting Channel and stuff. And you can also get it on Netflix.
You can watch several, I think 3 seasons, 6, 7, and 8 are on
they're on
Netflix,
I believe. Yeah, but he also has a podcast. That's great. Yeah. I remember watching a debate one time where he was at a book signing, like in a bookstore, and there was a vegetarian.
A vegan,
and they were kind of asking him, you know, why he hunts. And the way he explained it to the guy is, could you ask a wolf not to hunt? He said you couldn't, because it's an impossible question.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it's the same for him. And it is for most mankind. If you really think about it, throughout the history of mankind, from the beginning of time just until the last, like, 150 years.
Not even that. Probably the last, let's say, 40 or 50 years, it seems.
Every human hunted.
Yeah.
So, in reality, hunting is a part of being human. And so, to, you know, ask somebody not to be a hunter is kind of a ridiculous question. If you think about it, I mean, we have the ease. I understand not wanting to partake in it yourself.
Yeah.
But I think it has a bad rap with people. You know, there are those idiots out there that just shoot for sport. And that's not what it's about.
And there's every hobby and everything that anybody does and every line of work, there's good and there's bad.
Absolutely. So absolutely.
The bad always seems to be the ones that get the spotlight. That's just the way it is. So
yeah. What do you got planned for your week?
I have a lot of work I have to get done this week. And the weather better cooperate because it's all weather-based things. But other than that, just the same old, and that's pretty much it. I've been that's doing a lot of cooking, dude. I've been doing a lot of cooking because, like I said, I've got the one whitetail I harvested, and I'm trying to get a couple more in the freezer before season wraps up. And season wraps up this Sunday, so...
Yeah, and I got a bunch of sheep head in here frozen. The poor man's lobster. I'm going to give you some of that. Dude, and I got some redfish, too.
We are
going to
tear that up. We are going to tear it up.
I'm going to look for some more recipes. Yeah, pretty cool. If you have any stories of your own you'd like to share with me and Cam, just like Justin did at the beginning of the show, you can email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828. And you can follow me and Cam on all forms of social media. Till next time, I think we might be doing another off-the-cuff episode this week. We'll see. If not, we may be doing it this weekend. Till next time, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.